told you we should have a guide.
What do we need a guide for?
Well, put down the canoe for a minute.
Well, okay. Now, put down your own chair,
please.
I'd just like you to explain to me why we need a guide. Haven't I done all right?
Well, with a guide, we would have reached the civilized spot long before this.
Oh.
Besides, carrying a canoe from one dinky patch of water to another is no fun.
Now, just a minute. We're heading in the right direction, aren't we?
I wouldn't know.
What do you mean, I wouldn't know? We're going east, aren't we?
How should I know? I've been walking with the canoe over my head. Do you know?
Well, of course. The sun's right over there, isn't it?
How do you know? You can't see it, can you? With all these trees.
Well, no. But just to prove that I'm right, you hand me that compass there.
You'll have to shift for yourself, John. That compass wasn't any good. I threw it away a few miles back.
Threw it away?
Yeah.
What did you do that for?
It didn't work. It only kept pointing in one direction. And we aren't going that way.
Oh, Emerson Markham to the rescue, please. I say that advisedly, ladies and gentlemen, for our science reporter has been talking with Dr. Charles H. Smiley, director of Ladd Observatory at Brown University, who is an expert at showing people how to find their way without instruments. That's true, isn't it, Emerson?
It certainly is, Bob. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen?
How did Dr. Smiley happen to become interested in such emergency tactics, Emerson?
Well, he says he's been interested in mathematical astronomy since his college days at the University of California. And then, not so very long ago, a friend of his in the Navy pointed out to him that there was a need for emergency navigation methods, that men sometimes found themselves adrift on rafts with no idea as to where they were or which way they should go.
So that's what we'll be finding out about, a new way of navigating.
Yes, Bob, Dr. Smiley's method. Anyway, to navigate by conventional methods, one needs previous training, special instruments, and certain tables of mathematical and astronomical data. The lack of any one of the three, training, instruments, or tables, is enough to prevent navigation as ordinarily practiced.
Do you mean that if you can't have all three, you might as well not have any of them?
That's just about the size of it, Bob. At least the problem was to find a method of navigation so simple that one would need no special training to use it, a method requiring an absolute minimum in the way of equipment and tables. It was Dr. Smiley's hope that the method could be used by any person who can make change in a grocery store or who can read a railroad timetable with understanding.
Rather modest requirements, one possible exception. How'd he go about it?
Well, the first thing Dr. Smiley did was to find out what would be the very least in the way of instrumental equipment one could get along with. Then he proceeded to build the method around that minimum equipment.
Yes, but what did he decide was minimum equipment?
Well, a careful examination of the problem showed that a person could not determine longitude without using some sort of timekeeper, a watch, that. Fortunately, it turned out that a watch was not only necessary for longitude, but was sufficient for latitude, too. And it's something that's owned by most men.
Come, come. You mean to say that you don't need anything more complicated than a watch to determine your position? How about a sextant or something like that? Don't you have to measure any angles? Wouldn't you at least need a pocket compass?
No, only a watch. And you don't need to be a trained observer. You need only see the first glimpse of the sun above the horizon at sunrise and note the time. And then you must note the time of sunset, the disappearance of the last bit of the sun below the horizon.
Takes a full day to get your bearings? It's a lot of time.
Well, if you're lost or afloat on an ocean, time is the one thing you have a lot of. The number of hours and minutes between sunrise and sunset is enough to determine one's latitude, and from the time of local noon, that's a time halfway between sunrise and sunset, of course, you can find the longitude west of Greenwich.
Well, when you say it, it sounds very simple. But I bet you have to have some rather complicated mathematical formulas or at least some long tables handy to use.
No, not at all, Bob. All you need is simple arithmetic. Addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. The instructions and the necessary tables, together with an illustrative example, cover only one side of one sheet of paper, 8.5 by 11 inches. The size of an ordinary sheet of typewriter paper. Dr. Smiley had them printed with waterproof paper and waterproof ink. He hopes eventually to see a copy in every lifeboat and every life raft on every ship and every plane owned by the United States, perhaps on everyone belonging to the United Nations.
Well, maybe I'm a born pessimist or something, but there must be a catch somewhere. It sounds too easy. Isn't there some place where this new system of finding your way is weak?
Well, they're taken care of anyway. The weaknesses of the method are listed on that sheet of instructions, too. Obviously, it won't work up in the polar regions where at one time of the year the sun does not rise and at another time of the year, the sun does not set. It is useful only between 60 degrees north and 60 degrees south latitude. There are also 2 days in the year, March 21st and September 23rd, when the length of the day is practically the same all over the earth. For about a week before and a week after each of these dates, the latitude will be poorly determined from the length of the day.
Does it affect the longitude, too?
No. Longitude is found as accurately as ever during this interval. Where the navigator of a ship hopes to find his position to within a mile, and for a plane 5 miles is considered adequate, a position found by this method will be only good to within about 30 or 40 miles. That is, assuming that the watch is a moderately good one.
All right, now suppose we know where we are. How are we going to find out which way to go? Didn't you say that Dr. Smiley's method would show you the way to go home?
Yes, Bob. And to do that, you use the stars at night. Suppose that you knew that a particular star, say Gamma Andromedae, would be seen directly overhead at Boston at 8:13 p.m. tonight. When that time came, you could point your lifeboat toward that star and start toward Boston. Then after 23 hours and 56 minutes, the star would be over Boston again, and you could again determine your course. You'll need a compass to hold the course through the day, and it won't do you much good to know which way to go if your lifeboat doesn't have a sail or a rudder. But even so, on a raft, it would be nice to know whether it would be better to put up a coat for a sail or to leave it down.
Well, Emerson, you can find which way to go to Boston, but suppose you're much nearer to Dakar, or suppose you're adrift in the Pacific, what then?
Stars and times are given on the sheet for 14 ports in the Atlantic and 20 ports in the Pacific. You can not only determine the direction, but also the distance to each of these ports. The instructions are all written out. Do this, then this, then this.
Yes, but Emerson, not everyone knows the stars by name. Suppose I can't tell Aldebaran from Betelgeuse, and I can't.
Well, Dr. Smiley was prepared along those lines too, Bob. He's made a special star map, which shows about 300 of the brightest stars in the sky, and with only a little study, you should be able to identify the stars you'll need. The star map has been made a part of the sheet of instructions and tables.
But at the times of the year when we couldn't find which way to get home with this method?
The method is fairly efficient, so long as you don't travel at a speed of more than 20 knots. Of course, if you go faster than that, you can't very well be said to be adrift.
Well, going a little fast doesn't seem a bad idea to me, but I suppose there's some reason.
Indeed, there is. You see, at a reasonably slow speed, you'll travel along a great circle course, which is the shortest path between 2 points on the surface of a sphere. It is true that the nearer you get to your destination, the less precise will be the determination of your course. But if you're going to be lost, I'm sure you'd prefer to be lost in the vicinity of your destination.
I'll second that thought. Now there's something I'd like to know. Has there been anything like these methods before, or are they entirely new?
Of course, navigation has been practiced for a very long time. It would be surprising if any entirely new method were to be discovered. Dr. Smiley's second method, the one which tells you which way to go, is very much like one used by the Micronesians years ago on their long voyages between islands in the South Pacific. Of course, they didn't have watches, which makes the modern method easier to use, but they knew their stars. As for the first method, Dr. Smiley says he hasn't found it yet in print, but he's still expecting to find it in some old textbook on navigation.
Has Dr. Smiley heard of any shipwrecked sailor who has used his method?
No, he says not, although many times he's told men that he'd be interested to hear from any person who uses his method. One time when he was lecturing on emergency navigation methods to a group of officers, he said that he would appreciate hearing from them any criticisms or comments, favorable or otherwise, which they cared to make after using his method. One cheerful fellow stopped after the lecture and said, "That request of yours for criticisms and comments reminded me of the guarantee on the parachute. If this parachute does not open, return it to us and we will refund your money."
Well, perhaps you'll get some reports later. As I understand it, the Navy doesn't allow men to write concerning the sinking of ships at sea for fear information may be given to the enemy. At any rate, Emerson, thanks for telling us about this new way of finding your way. And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like a copy of a special paper prepared for us by Dr. Charles H. Smiley, director of Ladd Observatory at Brown University, whose system we've been discussing here, we'll gladly send you one free of charge, plus the actual sheets of instructions which have been compiled for those men in our armed forces who find themselves adrift without the usual instruments for navigation. All you have to do to get both the scientific paper and the instruction sheet is address a postcard to Excursions in Science in care of the station to which you are now listening, asking for scientific paper number 134, How to Find Your Way Without Instruments. That's How to Find Your Way Without Instruments, scientific paper number 134. That's all you need mention. The instruction sheets will be enclosed right along with the scientific paper. Now it's time once again for that portion of our program regularly devoted to the answering of the scientific inquiries sent in by you listeners. All the answers reflect the most up-to-date and accurate fact, since they are based on information supplied by staff members of the General Electric Research Laboratory or other equally trustworthy sources. All set, Emerson? Let's start the ball rolling with this. Rather unusual one from a gentleman in Benson, Vermont, who tells us he'd like to place a copy of an old newspaper between panes of glass and frame it so that it'll be preserved. He'd like to have some advice on treating the paper so it'll lie flat and the printing on it'll be preserved. What can you advise, Emerson?
An ordinary window glass should protect the paper. We've heard of various uses of orange and amber glass for this purpose.
Why do they use these colors, Emerson?
It seems that amber glass will filter out the violet as well as the ultraviolet rays. But the ordinary glass should protect the paper from these rays, about 99.9%. However, means should be taken to protect the paper from air and moisture.
How can you do that?
Oh, simply by sealing around the edges.
Well, what did you suggest using for this purpose?
Any drying agent, such as a silica gel or granular powder. The powder can be sprinkled between the panes of glass and around the edges. And then shellac or varnish can be applied around the edges to further enclose it safely. We also consulted Alexander J. Wall, director of the New York Historical Society, for his advice. He suggested several methods. One is to laminate the paper between two sheets of cellulose acetate film with either a glassy or a dull finish. It seems that the National Archives in Washington, D.C. treat many of their manuscripts in this way.
Does anyone else do it in any other way?
Yes. Another way to preserve the paper is to place it between crepoline transparent silk. This silk preserves it, and this process has been in existence for many years. There are a number of institutions which treat documents in this manner.
But neither of these methods that you've mentioned use glass, as our listeners suggested, do they?
Not the two which Mr. Wall suggested, no. With both of these methods, the paper can be handled the same as if it were the original paper.
And that's certainly an advantage.
Exactly. But if you place the paper between glass, you immediately encounter the greater disadvantage that if it should be dropped, everything is ruined.
Now, this next listener asks if the cutting of paper does any harm to a pair of good household shears or picking shears. Well, that's interesting. I think a good many of our listeners like to know the answer to that one.
The cutting of paper does not harm a good pair of scissors, Bob. In fact, probably there's nothing else that would be easier on the scissors than the cutting of paper.
I notice you say good scissors, Emerson.
Well, I mean hardened steel. The cutting of paper should not take the edge off scissors made of this material. And you'll observe that our listener used the word good, so we assume he means scissors of this type.
Our next question is from a Malden, Massachusetts listener who tells us he once coiled a piece of copper wire and placed it over the flame from a lighted candle. The flame was extinguished. He'd like to know if this was due to the copper absorbing the heat.
That's essentially what happened. You see, copper is a very good conductor of heat. So the copper conducted the heat away so fast that the gases of the flame were cooled below the combustion point, and they stopped burning.
I suppose any good conductor of heat will show the same effect.
Oh, yes. Silver, for example, would do it as well as copper because silver is also a good conductor. But it'd be much harder to do it with iron because iron is a poorer conductor. And lead, of course, would be still more difficult to use because lead is a very poor conductor of heat.
And now we hear from one of our friends who lives in Houston, Texas. He writes of a spot in Oregon, 25 feet in diameter, where a set of scales will not work because of the neutralization of the Earth's gravity at that point. Now, what do you say to that, Emerson?
As far as we know, there is no place on Earth where gravitational force does not exist. Small variations may occur due to the distribution of heavy masses under the surface of the Earth, however. Also, it is possible that there might be some local magnetic irregularity which might affect some iron or steel instrument.
Our next inquiry comes from a gentleman who would like to know what causes a balloon to rise in the air. He wonders if something attracts it from the side.
The balloon rises because it is lighter than the air. You see, the balloon and the gas it contains is lighter than the corresponding volume of air which it pushes aside, and it therefore rises. No, nothing attracts it. It's just the buoyancy of the air that takes it up.
And speaking of motion away from places, we better start one right now. So I'll just say thank you, Emerson Markham, and goodbye, everyone, until our next excursion in science.